We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where this podcast episode was produced. SBS Italian pays our respects to the Cammeraygal people of the Guringai Nation and their elders, past and present. We also acknowledge the traditional owners from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands you're listening from today. Italian cuisine is one of Australia's favourites, and there's no doubt Italian cuisine is a celebrity in the world of food. But there are many dishes, weird and wonderful specialities that don't make it beyond the Italian border. Check your pantry. Can you see a pig's head there? You'll need one today. My name is Massimiliano Gugole, and in this SBS Italian podcast series, I'll tell you the story of ugly dishes that tell us something new about Italian cuisine and the love that Italians have for food. Everything but the squeal, they say. In a pig, everything has a purpose in the kitchen, and that's true almost everywhere in the world. Sicilian cuisine has excellent examples of this. In the cities of Catania and Ragusa in particular, a terrine brings together some of the less noble parts of the pig. The rind, the tail, but also the ears, the tongue, basically the entire head.
Oh, looks hog-like.
It looks, I don't know, it looks like maybe pork?
I don't like anything piggy, so no, I would never ever try it. I could not.
It doesn't look appetizing there when I can look into the whites of its eyes.
And yeah, just seeing that pig's head there would put me off it, so I don't think I would eat it.
As a child, I think I was scarred. I saw the movie where they cut the pig and they made the salami and with the blood, nah, it's not for me.
A tureen made of pig's ear and other assorted components. No, thank you.
Some call it liatina, others zuzu. In Italian, it's gelatina di maiale. It's a winter specialty, often on the festive tables of those who got it for Christmas. A dish that brings us back in time. We will explore it today with Marisa Ragnolo Wilkins, author of the book Sicilian Seafood Cooking and of the blog All Things Sicilian and More. Hi, Marisa.
Well, good morning. Buongiorno, Massimiliano. I like the sound of your name, so I'm going to call you that.
I like the sound of your name, too. Now, so your family and also you are from Ragusa, if I'm not wrong.
Sort of. I always struggle with this. I mean, even in Italy, when people ask me where I'm from, I always say I was brought up in Trieste. My parents lived in Trieste, but I was born in Sicily, as my parents were as well. My mother's family moved to Trieste when she was 5 and stayed there until her father died, and then half of the family went back to Catania, where they came from. But my father's family is in Ragusa, and he was stationed there during the war as a policeman, of all things. And he met my mother and they married. But then I was conceived and they thought they should catch a train to Ragusa. And I was born in my grandmother's bed. And then 10 days later, they brought me back to Trieste. So I don't know what I am and I live in Australia. What do you think I should answer?
I don't know. We'll get back to that later with a few more details. But I believe in the Ragusa area, they call the dish that we'll talk about today liatina.
Yes, they do.
I was going to ask you first, what's the look of this dish? Is it scary? Because it sounds scary.
It is very scary. My advice to you is not to tell anybody what's in it. You just present it on the table and it looks fabulous, because it's covered in jelly and you put it on the table, especially if it's attractive, and they'll taste it and say it's terrific. The problem is if you tell them what's in it.
So it's not the look of the final product, is the process.
No, it's the process, and you end up with all these squish. Your hands, it's like playing with soft, squishy Play-Doh.
And okay, so you don't invite your friends when you're making it?
No. And in fact, I have some friends who are coming to dinner tomorrow night, and they were in the diary a long time before this started. And they rang to see what time, different friends. And the male said, I'm really excited by this. I'm really looking forward to it. When I mentioned it to my other friend, and she said, Ooh, my father. I didn't tell her what was in it. I just said it's brawn. You know, it's a type of brawn. Famous Sicilian dish. Only from, it's very regional. Comes from only the southwestern part of Sicily. I built it up. Anyway, she said, my father, who was English, he made brawn and I can still smell it going through the house. I didn't dare tell her that it took me a long time to get rid of the smell of the pig's head and all of those bits and pieces that were in the large stock pot.
I was going to ask you, what's the smell of the thing?
For the first couple of hours, awful. And then it starts to concentrate and you get a consommé smell, as you would. And we have to remember it's full of collagen. And everybody's into collagen at the moment. Everybody's making bone soup. You know, that's the latest thing, like Nduja. Everybody's using Nduja. We go into fads. And it's really very healthy. And I made two terrines because one of my friends is on a very strict keto diet and she's into fat and protein. And so I made her one and delivered it to her. And she's thrilled. She wrote back and she says it's marvellous. But she also has that thinking that it's going to do her the world of good. So it's not just the taste. It's if it's good for you. And it is good
and healthy,
for you.
Good and healthy. Fantastic. Where do you go when you need to buy a pig's head?
Well, that was good fun because at different times when I've bought a pig's head, I have found them usually in the Asian stalls in the market. And also you can go to Italian butchers, but you have to order it. I didn't have time to order it and I thought, I'm not going to have any problem. Off I went on Thursday thinking that I might have to order it from one of the stalls because it's not the thing that they have out because people are repelled by it.
Not so many people buy it. Well, exactly, because that's part of the name of the Catanian name, Zuzzo. It means dirty, sozzo, like in Italian.
Something that is repulsive to you that you don't want. And sure enough, it is. And so I went looking for a pork's head and none of the Asian stalls had it. I found an Italian one, well, Italianate. I said, look, I'll come in on Saturday morning. This is Thursday. And he said, no, look, take it now. It's going to be in your fridge or my fridge. Take it now. It's not going to break the bank. I'm going to charge you $7.50 for the whole head. And I said, I can't put it in my saucepan. I have this huge stock pot. How can I possibly fit? And I said, well, look, could you cut it in half? And I'll take it all but throw away, you know, the other bit. There was no way I could have made it. And he said, all right, look, I'll give you a half. And so I took a half. But it also had a pork's hock in there and the head had the tongue, which I wanted.
Right.
Should I go on?
No, well, I think for some of the listeners that might be enough. But
you know, the worst part was that before I put it into the pot, I really didn't want the eye in there and I had to gouge it out. And that was very, very difficult. Now, can you imagine me talking about this tomorrow night when my guests are sitting at the table?
I think you should cover that over dessert, maybe. That's for fun.
Nothing goes to waste when pigs are used to prepare food. We've had a few examples in our podcast series. And today's dish, gelatina di maiale, is yet another one. Pigs are considered unholy by major religions like Islam and Judaism, but for billions of other people, they are an invaluable resource. I talked about what makes them special with Luca Govoni, who taught for years history and culture of Italian cuisine at ALMA, a leading Italian training institution for hospitality.
Nothing is wasted of the pig. That's something that's been true since the Middle Ages, when in fact nothing of anything was wasted. You can use whole cuts, you can mince it, you can use its fat to make salami, and once upon a time it was even used to light up churches and other indoor spaces. Imagine the smell. But there's also an interesting medical aspect, because some organ transplants use pig organs as its tissues, since they're some of the closest in the animal world to humans.
In alcune culture si continua a usare tutto.
Some cultures still today use everything from the pig, blood included. The idea of taste or disgust is specific to a time and place. It depends on where we are and the time in history we live in, with all the different factors at play, such as how available food is, or the beginning of new ethical, moral, political, religious trends. We ourselves in Italy have enjoyed and then banned certain types of meat. Think of dolphins or tortoises, still in recipe books from the 60s in Italy. I even have a recipe book published after World War II with a recipe for grilled harvest mouse. You had to give a bit of lambrusco to the mouse and then slice it in half and put it on the grill. The pig rocked on. I don't know if you remember that wonderful quote from George Orwell's Animal Farm. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. It was the pig's dominion. The pig has overcome all obstacles in our culture. It's part of our culture. Think of Bengodi, the village described in Boccaccio's Decameron. The landlord roamed around riding a pig. Not a lamb, not a horse, a pig. The animal that has given so much to us and that we love as we portray it in paintings and we love as we narrate in tales. There was even a book, Praises of the Pig, 65 pages, no less, of praises. And the Testament of the Pig. Goodness, I'd forgotten about that. It was written around the 15th century. Imagine, it's a pig writing his will. And it says, "My dear admirers and preparers, I ask you behave well with my body and that you dress it with tasty condiments, with almonds, pepper, and honey, so that my name be praised forever. Signed, Big Lard, Big Steak, Cumin, Sausage, Coppa, Salami, and Prosciutto." It's genius.
This dish, we call it interchangeably. We call it zuzu, which I believe is the name that's most common around Catania or Liatina, that's used in the area of Ragusa. These two neighboring cities that both love what in Italian we call gelatina di maiale, which is in English pork jelly or pork terrine. Can I ask you, when was the first time you tried it? Do you remember?
Yes, I do. Although we lived in Trieste, my dad had 2 months off every year. And so for the summer holidays, we always went to Sicily. And there, both families, because we had some in Catania and some in Ragusa, and we also toured around, visited other cities, etc. My aunt, my father's sister from Ragusa, made it because I was very keen on tasting everything because it was so different. And she made it, but I don't remember her using a half a pig's head. Butchers there are so different. You know, they'll cut it up into little parcels for you. I came home with a half a pork's head full of blood in the plastic bag because it came in a plastic bag. And when I took it, A clear plastic bag so you could see the eye. And my partner was out when I went because I wasn't expecting to have it. And it was in the fridge. And I thought, I better tell him that there's a pig's head there. So when he opens the fridge, he knows what it is because the eye is there.
And he's looking at you.
And you look at fish and you think, you know, you want a clear eye. It was pretty clear.
Oh, my God. No, it's getting too much even for me. All right, let's go back to our dish, the gelatina, liatina, zuzu. Can you describe to me its taste? You said it's a good taste despite, you know, all the gruesome preparation. What's it taste like?
Well, actually, because you reduce the liquid, the brodo, the broth, until it, you know, it's jelly. It's a thick jelly. You actually have a concentrated taste. And as I said before, there are a lot of bones in there. So you end up with a really strong consommé. And then, this is where I always insist with any recipe, you have to taste it. You can't just say half a teaspoon of salt. You know, the recipe will tell you a tablespoonful of vinegar, this and that. You can't cook like that, or at least I don't. You have to taste it and then trust your palate and say, okay, it needs more salt, it needs whatever. But anyway, so first of all, you have the strong consommé. After that, you add vinegar and lemon juice. And that brings out the tartness. The fat is not important. You skim it off anyway as you cook. Some people don't. I can imagine that in the good old days it would have been made, as one of my friends said, who is Sicilian, that her parents used to make it when they had slaughtered the pig, after they had cut all of the pieces of meat that they wanted for their consumption, as well as made, you know, the salumi, as well as the sausages, and then all of the bits that were left over. Nothing is wasted, which is great. That's another thing that you tell people. Nothing is wasted. We're using everything. So sustainably, this is a good thing, just like the collagen and the keto diet. So they used to put, I can imagine, in a cauldron and let it boil away and then attack it. And really, it's not a very good sight. But you have to remember, I was amazed at the different textures and colour of the flesh that is inside the head. I ended up with white bits, I ended up with dark bits, because I can see you're going, yuck.
Well, I think everybody is at the moment.
But I took off, and I actually like the skin of pork. So what I did was I took away the obvious fat and left some of the gelatinous. When we used to have brodo at home, my dad and I, my mother didn't. She was a purist. But my dad and I used to share the bones. You know, I love big bones. I even like chicken bones. I chew on them. My partner thinks, blech. But I like that sort of gelatinous thing. And besides, it's very good for me, isn't it, because of the collagen?
Nice.
Pigs have been valuable assets for many Italian farmers for many, many years. In medieval Italy, you could even measure land in pigs. That is how many animals a certain area could support. That secular tradition has produced many preparations, famously leaving very little to waste. And the history lives on, even on the other side of the planet. Peter Mastro now offers Italian-style cured meats in his Saluminista shop in the busy Flinders Lane of Melbourne. But how he got there is a fascinating story, and one that many Australians can relate to.
My father was born here. His brother and sister were born in Italy, and they came over when they were young, and my father was born here. So I didn't get to experience a lot of really old-school ways, because his father passed away when I was very young, and my nonna passed away not long after that. So my father, for a first generation, is quite modern Australian, Italian, but came from a very old world background. So my salami making didn't start till my late years. So I was about 20 to 21. Always been a big salami fan my whole life. Literally since I was a little boy, every single day for school lunch, my entire school life, I had salami and bread. It's installed in me from a young age.
It's a classic. But you started to make it when you were a young adult, yeah, not when you were a child.
And a young adult. So I was introduced to it later on. So the concept of not wasting anything didn't come naturally to me till we started making it. So obviously we used to make, order in just a couple of legs and make some salami. And then over the years we would simply bring it into the 20th century and improve the recipe and keep it consistent and measure with scales rather than measuring salt with our hands. You know what I mean? And then through that process, there was one year we decided to get the whole pig, go to the farm, kill the pig, gut it, hang it, dry it, skin it, everything, start to finish. And in that process, we obviously didn't want to waste anything, so we're back to that cucina povera kind of concept where everything in the pig gets used. So you'd make coppa from the neck, you'd make pancetta from the belly, you'd make salami from the legs and the shoulders, and you'd make guanciale from the cheeks. And then basically whatever was left over, all the nonni would get together and they get a really big pot, and we used to call it the pig pot because it was disgusting. It was a massive pot. They'd load it with salt and load it with the tails and the hoofs and the ears and the eyes and whatever was left, and just cook it and cook it and cook it and cook it and cook it. And we used to look at it like, oh my God, that is disgusting.
Right.
There's no way I'm eating that. But essentially, they did. And to be honest, I tried it. It's essentially boiled salted pork. It just looked really bad. Yeah? You've got half a tail hanging out, a couple of ears hanging out, and this massive pot.
There was someone you knew,
Yeah, so that was my brother-in-law's father. That was kind of my first introduction to a really, really, really ugly Italian dish that did taste good.
Did you do anything with the blood of the pig?
Well, funny you should say that. When we went to the farm, I'll never, ever forget, went to the farm, so they string the pig up by its feet and it's hanging down. They'd throw boiling water on it, shave it. They went to slice it and gut it, and all of a sudden, I'll never forget, all of a sudden out of nowhere, this lady starts screaming and running towards the nose of the pig with the saucepan, and she caught all the blood. So she just sat underneath, caught all the blood, and apparently she made soap with it.
That might appear a bit gruesome to some, but in fact, it shows respect to the animal.
It does, and that's kind of why we needed to do the process, where we needed to go to the farm, see what it took to kill a pig's life, have an appreciation for the animal, and have a better understanding to respect it and not to waste anything. Yeah? Back in the day when they had nothing, they had one pig, they weren't going to throw out offcuts and make something of it.
You started later in life to do this process to salami making. Yeah. What brought you there? Because normally it's something that you grow up with. It's not something
Absolutely. Yeah, having been a salami fan, and it's gone full circle. It's unbelievable that that's where it's taken me now, that my business is based on salami and small goods and passion and what we're passionate about. And I said to my brother-in-law, who is now my business partner as well, Frank, I said, we need to learn. And his dad used to make it. So we asked him one year, can you show us next time you make salami? We want to do it with you. We don't want to be just rock up and eat the homemade salami and go home, because these things need to be noted down and respected and something we want to do. So we did that and learnt their way. And over the years, obviously, the way they learnt and the way they used to do things, very different, very old school, to a point where we would start to document, take notes, write down recipes. I'll never forget the first time we did it. They would measure two handfuls of meat would be one handful of salt. Now,
that's all you need. Great.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Amazing. And we said, okay, that's crazy. It was an amazing process. And then from there on, we made it every single year. Our business, Salaministi, came from the very first Melbourne Salami Festival. We entered our homemade salami. And because Frank and myself became quite fastidious and perfectionate about how we made it, because we loved it, we created a really good product. And the very first Salami Festival, we came second place, and we missed out on first place by 1 point. From that, I had a cafe and a wine bar in Middle Park, and the culture and the people in the area had also never had access to this kind of food, to home-cured salami. So I put on a day where we made homemade salsiccia, porchetta panini, and sampled homemade salami all day.
And it was a success.
Massive success. So Frank and I did a couple of events, looked for a shop. We ended up opening up a pop-up shop in North Melbourne for 12 months to creating the business we own today.
It came from love of the flavor. It became a business. But is it also part of your sort of search for an identity as a second-generation Italian, you think?
Absolutely. 100% who we are is an amalgamation of the traditions that our parents brought here and how they have adapted over the years. It's our version of Italy. And our version is the version we've gotten from our parents and our grandparents. We don't claim to be, you know, fully blooded Italian. I mean, I speak Italian, but it's terrible. If you heard me speak Italian, you'd be embarrassed. we just really own that respect and that appreciation for everything that they brought. A, and B, what they went through to get here. My nonno just passed away at 102 last year, and he was born in Filicudi, one of the Oli Islands, and what's happened and what he went through to create the family he's created here just blows our mind. Came here with nothing, and then when he passed away, his legacy is a beautiful family who have grown, flourished, love each other, respect each other, all get along, have made a full life for themselves here in Australia. A lot of them are business owners, contribute to the country, and just have created something beautiful.
I'm Marisa Daniolo Wilkins, and today I'm presenting Zuzu o Gelatina. The Italian for that is gelatina.
Is it a hard recipe to make?
No, but it's time-consuming, because what people don't realise is that, like all good things, you need to cook it, you need to rest it, you need to taste it, you need to start again. And there are quite a number of recipes, especially from the Ragusa region, where they like clear broth. Now, to get the jelly clear, you need to filter it through muslin many times. Italians cook by feel, by look, by taste, and what their mothers or their aunts cooked it. And, you know, they're traditionalists. They don't like to change things, the older generations. Things are changing now, but, you know. I really had the impression that the older recipes were made in poor people's homes, and they used the bits and pieces, the discarded bits, not the good bits, the discarded bits, and came up with gelatina. Then as history progressed and the nobili thought, this gelatina's rather nice. And so they started putting in, and also because I think the rest of the country, the rest of the newer generation would have been repulsed by what was in it, if they know. So the recipe developed, and you have all of those variations in names, like, you know, you've already mentioned the zuzu, which comes from zozo, which means repellent, filthy, negative connotations. But maybe according to some, it could be the synonym, the opposite, the rich and tasty. Or it could come from sudz or sulze, which is ancient German, and the word is sulazza, which means gelatina or brodo or lubricated. So you have all of these food historians now trying to determine where it came from. But who knows? Who knows? There was a very interesting thing too. I mentioned to you that there was blood in the plastic bag when I actually got the head out, because the head has quite a bit of blood. And there's another thinking, there's another derision of words, and the word is sucidus, which is Latin, which means avere le mani imbrattate di sangue.
Wow.
So right. All of these people have tried to get into the history where, you know, it was just an ordinary peasant dish that they used every bit of the pig and put it in a big saucepan and made gelatina and enjoyed it, usually at Christmas time, because pigs are slaughtered when they're fat and they've had the good season to eat. I don't know what they eat.
Giandole. Well, it depends where they live.
Acorns. And they're slaughtered when they're fat.
Let's jump to the recipe, Marisa. Maybe someone will try to make this gelatina at home. So what should they buy? What's the shopping list?
Well, you need cartilage. And therefore, if you need cartilage, you could do what I used to make gelatina once upon a time, usually with hocks. It was only later that I started experimenting with heads. But you need a butcher to be able to cut it in a way that it will fit into your largest saucepan, which is a bit of a problem. But that's what you need. And by having a half head, I had the tongue, I had the cheeks, which in itself are different textures and good supplies of meat. And you also have all of the bones that produce that wonderful stock.
Beside the meat, what do we need?
You need peppercorns and you need bay. I really like bay. And if you think of others, Italian cuisines, bay is very, very popular, very, very good. And the lemon juice and the vinegar, because that lifts it at the end. And that's how you season the gelatina, the jelly part that goes around the meat.
Right. Can you talk us through the process?
Yes. But what I didn't mention was that I not only just use a half a pig's head and a hock, I was worried about not having enough meat in there. And so I bought 250 grams of pork from the neck because it's nice and fatty and it can be sinewy as well, and made sure that I had a tongue. So if I didn't have a tongue, I would have bought a tongue, because once again, it's texture and look as well as taste. So what you do is you rinse it, you make sure you rinse it because there was an awful lot of blood, and then take out the eye if you're using the head. And that was quite difficult. It took me a long time. The eyes are really difficult to gouge out. You have to cover it. So you put the meat in and you have to make sure that you cover it with water and some salt. Now, if you're using different meats as I did, where I took out the tongue, a whole tongue, and the pork neck, I added it 1 hour before the cooking was finished because of the different sizes and because there was no bone on that. It was just the meat. So it makes sense to add it. Not that the recipes told you that. You just stick everything in and you kill it to death. Then you drain it. But you make sure that you drain it from the hot liquid. And the reason I did that, not that the recipes necessarily told you, the reason I did that is because the fat hasn't had time to adhere to the cold meat. So you're better off lifting it off. Separating all of the meat from the bones. And that's when I started to appreciate the different textures and colours. Then you have to deal with the broth. So I put it in the fridge, left the meat there, because it comes apart anyway. You know, you don't end up with big slabs of meat. It's all bits and pieces, and you make sure that you remove the bits that you don't want. So, for example, there was a half a brain in there. I'm making it exciting, aren't I? And I thought, should I put this in the gelatina or should I throw it out? I put a little bit of brain in there, but I mostly threw that out. But you can feel it with your fingers. You can see what you want. And then you have to decide how much meat, how much jelly, because the recipes won't necessarily tell you that either, or the size of the mould. But every time I've made it, I've always had more meat than jelly. It looks nicer when you cut it. Not everybody likes jelly either, especially if you're going to have jelly and it has to be clear. It just takes too long. So once you have the meat, put it in the fridge and then you deal with the broth. And the best way to deal with the broth, I actually left it overnight in the fridge, is because when it gets cold, when it solidifies, you can just scrape the fat off. And then you really, this is where you need to taste it and work out how much vinegar, how much lemon juice does it need? Do you need more pepper? Do you need more bay leaves? Some people use cloves. My aunt actually didn't use cloves when she made it for me. But there are cloves, and I added cloves when I added the tongue and the pork neck because I didn't want it to taste too much of cloves. Okay, so we're back to the broth. You have to filter it, and I only filtered it once. I drained it through a fine mesh colander. I had the fluid. I then needed to clarify it, but I wasn't going to clarify the whole lot. I needed to work out how much fluid I needed. And at 700 mils, I thought would be enough. And to that, I tasted the broth. It tasted good. I put in the juice of one lemon and about 1.5 tablespoons full of vinegar. Tasted it again, didn't need salt. It was fine. And then you put your meat how you want it, but you don't squash it down because you pour broth on it, hot broth on it, and it gets inside the little spaces. Otherwise, you end up with just this meat and jelly on top. So you need to be careful. You just lay it down gently. You filter the broth, you heat it, you pour it on the cold meat that you've assembled in the tureens. And I always line my tureens with something, and this time I use paper, so that you can lift it. And then turn it upside down onto a plate. It just makes it easier. It's like a cake, inverting a cake. You know, you put enough butter on the sides in order for it to be inverted. The same with the terrine, although you can put it in hot water just to loosen it and then turn it over, but you may not necessarily get that nice, even texture. It looks good. Every time I've made it, it looks good and it tastes good. If there's any fat in it, it comes up to the surface. It prevents the air from going in. It acts as a seal. And you can also scrape it off when you turn it over and you present it with people who don't like fat. And I think Western society has got to the stage where nobody eats fat.
Because we don't need fat. If we needed fat, probably we would have to eat it.
Look, think of eggs. How many years did we go with you mustn't eat eggs because of the cholesterol? You mustn't have cream because it's bad for you. We sort of turn around a bit, don't we?
That's interesting. It's very, very cultural based. What's acceptable, what's not acceptable,
yes.
What's good, what's not good. It depends on where you live. It depends on the times you live in. So there's a lot of variables.
Well, that's good because you're actually putting it right in context. You cannot cook a recipe unless you appreciate where it's from, what they've used. Otherwise, you'd be using pineapple in pizza, wouldn't you?
Some people do, I hear.
I hear too. That's something I would never do because you have to respect the culture. Now, I'm not, you know, one of those traditionalists that says you mustn't make it modern because, like language, cooking evolves. We have to accept it. Mind you, if I gave the gelatina that I made to my aunt, who originally introduced me to, and every time I went back to Ragusa, she would go to one of the many butchers because it's also sold by the butchers in the Ragusa region. She would want me to taste them all, and there's always going to be gelatina in the fridge for me to taste, the same as the cheese that they make with chili, the soft cheese. There were cheese makers all over Ragusa. I had to taste all of those cheeses.
Everything. Sounds like a good childhood to me. I was going to ask you, you said you have a dinner planned with your friends when you're going to offer the zuzu liatina,
yes.
Gelatina. Have you tried to offer this in the past to your Australian friends? Have you
yes.
got any reactions?
They've always been Australian. And as I said to you, I've never told them what's in it until afterwards.
and they were happy.
Yes, because when you cut it, you will get, once again, the different types of meat. Now, tomorrow night, I'm a bit worried with a friend who said she has an English father and he used to have brawn at home. She couldn't stand it because she's associating the smell of the English brawn with what she's going to get on the table tomorrow night. So she's approaching it in a negative way. Whereas the other friend, he's approaching it very positively because, it's a Sicilian specialty, only made in southwestern Sicily. I'm all for it.
It's all down to marketing.
It is.
Can I ask you also how you eat it? Is that a standalone dish or does it go with something?
Well, you know, it's a bit like pizza that people make it for dinner. It's not. Pizza, you eat it as a snack. Sorry, I'm a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to having pizza for dinner. So you buy it from the butchers and it's just like small goods or somebody makes it and you don't have anybody left to make it anymore. You know, my aunt's dead now. Nobody in the family, none of the nipoti or aunts, the other aunts that are left, there's one, she wouldn't make it. So it's just eaten with bread. But I think because we have experienced different cuisines because of where we live, I usually present it as an entree. I went out to my balcony and I picked some arugula, some rocket, and I also put lemon, slices of thin lemon. I mean, in Italy, you might have it with some capers maybe or some giardiniera, which I think is very good because you're getting a different taste, you're getting a sour taste. But if I'm going to use leaves, I like to use things like endive, chicory, rocket, watercress, because of the taste. You know, you get the bitter taste in these leaves. You get the mustardy taste in these leaves. So it's a contrast. You would never serve it with lettuce. I wouldn't, because it's too sweet. You need a contrast, something pungent to lift it.
Can I just ask you a final question? Like, did anybody give you looks when you were carrying that bloody bag home? Yeah.
Look, I shop with a basket. I put it in a basket. Nobody knew. But the butcher I bought it from, because I went back when I looked at it and I thought, I need more meat. There's not going to be enough meat from a half a pig's head, and I can't buy a whole pig head because I can't fit it in. And so I went back and bought some neck, and I told him what had happened. And he said, oh, bring me photos. I want to see the whole process. I'm going to take it to him. And I don't know whether he's going to be a fan of gelatina or totally reject it.
We shall see. Thank you so much to Marisa Ragnolo-Wilkins to have recreated this very special Sicilian dish for us today.
Thank you, and I'm really sorry that I couldn't bring it in for you to taste. I had intended to, but you're in Sydney and I'm in Melbourne.
That's right. So that actually makes it similar to the people who are listening now. They can't taste it, but maybe they can make it. Maybe I will make it. Who knows?
Well, I don't think so after you've seen the photos.
Thanks for being with us in our second journey through the ugly ducklings of Italian cuisine. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Massimiliano Gugole, with support from the executive producer of SBS Italian, Magica Fossati, as well as Max Gosford, Joel Supple and Caroline Gates. A big thank you to the SBS Food team for their support as well. For more SBS Italian content, go to sbs.com.au/Italian, or to find more SBS podcasts in English, go to sbs.com.au/audio.